Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colleen McQuillan, a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Anne Eakin Moss about her new book, Only Among Women, Philosophies of Community in the Russian and Soviet Imagination, 1860 to 1940. Dr. Eakin Moss is an assistant professor in the Department of Comparative Thought and Literature at Johns Hopkins University. Anne Eakin Moss, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Anne, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I did my doctoral degree in Slavic languages and literatures at Stanford University, where this book was born as a doctoral dissertation. And then I've been teaching at Johns Hopkins University for the past 15 years in various positions. And I've had the privilege of being in a department variously construed as a comparative literature and a kind of intellectual history department. So I was able to put my background in Russian literature and intellectual history in dialogue with people who are thinking across comparative lines about a range of issues in aesthetics and philosophy, where a really pressing concern has been this understanding of community and intersubjectivity. And that really helped me crystallize the book into what it became. But I have, I guess, the first public announcement of a career change for me. I'm actually moving to the University of Chicago in the fall to join the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures there. So that's an exciting return to my roots for 2021.
That is very exciting. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited.
So you mentioned that you began your work on this project as your doctoral dissertation. I'm wondering if you could kind of walk us through how you discovered this topic of women's communities and their cultural representations.
Sure. The whole project really was born out of the sheer readerly pleasure I took in Tolstoy's War and Peace long ago before I, you know, at the very beginning of my doctoral career. And coming across these moments of pure pleasure in the relationships between young girls and then older women, you know, women at various stages of their lives, and I had this instinct that there was something strange and different about women's relationships in War and Peace, and wanted to understand what the genealogy of this relationship was, because couldn't think of any place in Western literature where women's relations really had a plot, had motivation. I mean, I think if you isolated the women's relations in War and Peace, it would create a novel. I mean, it would be the length of a novel in and of itself. And that kind of assumption was confirmed when I read Sharon Marcus's book, Between Women, Friendship, Desire, and Marriage in Victorian England. And in this book, she makes the argument that women's relations are really subordinate to the marriage plot in the Victorian novel. I thought the fact that Natasha and Sonia have this incredibly precious and important relationship that helps helps protect Natasha from some of the consequences of the affair, the abortive affair with Anatole at the beginning of War and Peace, and then, you know, blossoms into this mature relationship with Maria over Prince Andrei's deathbed. This was a novel in and of itself. It was really something different. So I embarked upon a project of collecting these moments of exceptional women's relations in Russian culture. And this set me backwards in time to Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done, and then forwards in time to the Stalinist musicals of Grigory Alexandrov and Ivan Pyrrhev. And I had this shock of recognition of both the Chernyshevskyan women's textile commune and the exceptional relationships, friendships in Tolstoy's War and Peace. So there's something incongruous. There was a problem there that I wanted to solve.
Mm. So you note here that Chernyshevsky, that why is that name complicated for us to say, that Chernyshevsky was sort of formative. And I recall a moment in the book where you write that, and I'm going to actually quote you here, that the book can be seen, quote, as a history of the reception of Chernyshevsky's What Is to Be Done by tracing a concept which in many respects was born with the novel. The notion that women's relations are inherently progressive. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I called the Chernyshevsky chapter rational because, of course, we associate Chernyshevsky with this idea of rational egoism, right? that utilitarian philosophy that one will choose to advance the greater good in order to benefit the self. But the male characters in the novel end up finding helping others to be some kind of a roadblock, right? That there will be some disadvantage to the self. But the female characters in the novel, of course, Vera Pavlova as the most important exemplar of this, makes decisions to help other people in order to help the greater good, specifically women, right? They see the plight of other women to be a barrier to their own happiness. And so the textile collective that the sewing collective that Vera Pavlovna creates multiplies in a progressive manner, in a kind of radiates from her and progresses out to the rest of society. And it's because of the series of dreams in which she imagines some kind of externalized goddess that inspires her to realize herself and her potential and her necessity of this project for the greater good. And that kind of mathematical progression of the greater good is something that, of course, Leo Tolstoy found anathematic to his sense of And Dostoevsky as well, although I don't write as much about Dostoevsky in the book. And so this assumption of a progressivism in women's relations is something that Tolstoy rewrites into a kind of instinctive sympathy that women have for other women that radiates out of their relationships in the novel into other spheres. And that's kind of crucial to Tolstoy. So it's not a progressivism in Tolstoy, but there's a similar sense that women are exceptional. That runs through Tolstoy, Chernyshevsky, and Dostoevsky. Right, they're very different thinkers and authors, but they have this common assumption of female exceptionalism. Of course, it's an exceptionalism that masks an essentialism, an essentializing notion of women's superiority. That, of course, comes from the biology that comes for Tolstoy in particular, but that also comes from an assumption that women don't have as much of a shell, like the shell of individualist autonomy that comes from the influence of Western Enlightenment philosophy. There's something that's less touched in women that allows them to overcome autonomy, egoism, and individualism.
I'm glad you mentioned the title of your chapter on Chernyshevsky, which is Rational, because I find the organization of your book and the chapter titles, which are each a single adjective, to be quite brilliant. Can you say a bit more about the chapter titles and why you chose them?
Sure, thanks. Yeah, I was able to distill, I decided I would distill the idea, the sense of community in each of the kind of chronotopes of the novel, of the book, into single words, because it captured, I mean, even though there are interesting ways in which, particularly in the Chernyshevsky chapter, right, I'm making the argument that Vera Pavlovna's instinct for community is something other than rational, but it captures the overarching the sense of that novel and its afterlives through the 1930s and through the Russian Revolution, and then each chapter kind of interrogates that overarching adjective, that phrase, rational. The Tolstoy chapter is called organic, and as kind of a shorthand for thinking about this notion of women's instinctive organic relationship to a kind of community that's construed as a national Russian community at the end of War and Peace, at any rate. And then the middle chapter is called Inoperative, and I think that's the term that's the most adjacent to my text. I mean, that comes less imminently from my text, because it's my way of interrogating Jean-Luc Nancy's idea of the inoperative community through the texts of Chekhov. There's, I guess I kind of left out in my overview of the book from Tolstoy and Chernyshevsky to the Stalinist tractor musical, this two middle chapters of the book, which are called Inoperative and Erotic. And they are the two chapters of the book that kind of undo in strange ways this idealism of women's community in the Chernyshevsky and Tolstoy chapters. So the chapter Inoperative treats Chekhov's late fiction mostly, and thinks about ways in which Chekhov unmakes all of the ideals of the 19th century novel. And I think most emblematic of that inoperative, and I'm sorry, the term in French is désouvré in Jean-Luc Nancy's work of 1986, I think it is. And this is a philosophical work that's intended to undo or to rethink the uses to which notions of community are put through the 20th century. Nancy is concerned mostly about fascism and Bolshevism as notions of community that that were the motivation for some of the bloodiest events of the 20th century. And so he's thinking about ways to imagine community in dialogue with deconstructionist thought about deconstructionist and existentialist thought of the 20th century, and thinking about ways in which community can be unworked and put in dialogue. I'll strike that. Pause and strike this. Nancy thinks about community only insofar. Okay, strike that again. Nancy defines community only insofar as it allows individual members of that community to think about their finitude. And this really resonated with me with my reading of Chekhov's works. And it was a paradigm that was not part of the vocabulary of my dissertation or my initial writing on Chekhov. But because in some ways at first I thought Chekhov was giving us a little bit of hope about the relationships among peasant women in the in light of the devastation of the Russian countryside at the end of the 19th century, and that there were little moments of reaching out between women in, I'm thinking particularly of the very end of Peasants, in which one of the women has been, one of the peasant women comes home after having been raped, and she's completely naked, and the her sister-in-law, who to whom she's been, you know, horrible throughout the story, you know, recognize what has happened to her without words, and you know, brings her in wordlessly and clothes her and comforts her. I mean, in those moments of comfort in the face of, you know, horrifying poverty, degradation, and environmental disaster in Chekhov's late stories, really struck me. But and I was anticipating seeing in these Chekhovian moments, I mean, in the relationship among the three sisters, you know, something salvific, and it was the concept of inoperativity and unworkness in Jean-Luc Nancy that gave me a vocabulary to talk about a community that was not salvific. It only was what it was. It was really just an enactment of vulnerability and a kind of human care in the face of finitude.
I wanted simply to follow up on the idea of how philosophies of community that are not originating in works of literature, but are either part of the cultural intellectual history of a particular moment, how some of those philosophies get imprinted into literary texts, right? So maybe you can also talk about some of the more traditional Russian philosophies of community that you see expressed in the texts you deal with.
Yeah, that's a great question, and you know, a question that we have to grapple with as literary scholars, right? What do we get out of the text, and what do we bring to the text, and how much can we put into the text externally? Yeah, well, I think in some ways I see, right, literary texts also as forms of philosophy. So bringing a text like Nancy's Inoperative Community to Chekhov is a way of making visible, I think, something that's already there in Chekhov's own thinking. On the other hand, I also think that there are ways in which, you know, texts, this is Yuri Lotman's idea, you know, become a repository of cultural memory, right? That they accumulate and crystallize some of those philosophies. Certainly, Tolstoy is grappling with Herder, with German Romanticism, with Herder, with Kantian philosophy in his novel. But then they're taking and remaking ideas. Okay, I'm losing my thread. I started with too many ideas all at once. Right. So, you know, Lotman thinks of, you know, texts as accumulating some kind of cultural memory, and Russian literature is not accumulating Jean-Luc Nancy, but it's a way for me to try to make visible a sense of the philosophy of vulnerability that I think Chekhov is making visible. Then I also, it's a really good question, but I'm
well, I just think about this concept of bratstva, brotherhood, that's so essential for communities of writers and artists from Pushkin and the Romantics up mm-hmm. to the symbolists who are deeply engaged with religious philosophers like Vladimir Solovyov, and how this idea of brotherhood at once implies community, but also one that is gendered. So I think your book is also engaging with the sort of normative masculine communities and the way they've been conceived of in Russian cultural history. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, when we get to the fin de siècle, we're also pushing up against the transformation of bratstvo into something more like the eternal feminine, right, or the divine Sophia, and embedded in the move the book makes to the turn of the century from Chekhov, then to the chapter that I called erotic, we get figurations of women together who come to symbolize this idea of merging with the all unity of Solovyov or Ivanov, in explicitly. And of course, these are writers who are engaged, who are thinking with Ivanov and Solovyov actively. So chapter 4 talks about Gorky Kuprin and Lydia Zinovyeva Anibal, and they're imagining this. They're imagining a community that's much more mystical and in a completely modernist new idiom. And they're hoping that they're using their works to try to give their readers an opportunity to concretize, so readership becomes almost a participatory way of experiencing the eternal feminine through their fiction. And the stories that I treat in chapter 4 include Gorky's story about the brothel Vaska Krasny and Kuprin's novel Yama. And they're both stories in which prostitutes work together to enact some kind of violent revenge on male society. And this is kind of the lead up to the 1920s and the period that Elliot Bornstein describes as a literature of men without women. Clearly there was a reason to try to expel the women, that there was the sense of kind of sexual threat that is manifested in this literature. And in some ways it's a way of thinking about these philosophies of decadence and decline, and enact them for revolutionary ends. I mean, to try to give them a force that rebels against the pacifism of Chekhov, and this idea of inoperativity. I think the writing of Gorky Kuprin and Kuprin, shows the potential, both the potential of the sexualized potential of this image, of women together, women exclusive of men. There's something threatening about it that we don't see in Tolstoy or Chernyshevsky's writing, but that then comes to the fore in the turn of the century fiction.
So the last chapter of your book, chapter 5, entitled Bolshevik, which you've alluded to this chapter already, but I'm wondering if we can talk about it a little bit more extensively, because it differs from the others in that it examines films. Why was it important for you to include the Soviet era visual representation of women's communities?
Yeah, it was a challenge. It was a challenge even as a dissertation, right, to move from literary texts to visual representation. But in part, I was following this constellation, this image of women together, it was reading Elliot Bornstein's book made me think. Right, well, maybe it's disappeared. I mean, I guess men without women means that women don't have a women don't play. Nope. Let me start that over again. Yeah, so it was a challenge to move from literary texts to writing about cinema, and in part, it's one of the reasons it took me so long to turn this project into a book, because I wanted to be able to learn the vocabulary and the vocabulary, the tactics of film theory, in order to write authentically about cinema. But I was really following this theme of women, groups of women exclusive of men. There are so many women together in Soviet cinema of the 1930s, in musical films, in kind of dramatic films, films of all genres have women interacting. I mean, Soviet cinema of the 1930s often passes the Bechdel test in ways that are surprising. But it was also my sense through the study that I wanted to try to trace not just an image of women together, but also to try to have a sense of the effects and affects of this theme on readers and spectators of the time. So in each chapter, I tried to try to find some evidence of the impact of the writing of first Chernyshevsky and then Tolstoy on readers and interpreters of the day. I mean, to try to understand what it meant for this idea of women's community to manifest itself. And so moving to Stalinist cinema also meant moving to the genre that had such purchase in the 1930s, because these films were wildly popular. I mean, had a wildly popular following, and the stars of the films got fan mail, and women would write to Lyubov Orlova and say, "Oh, I want to be just like the hero of Svetliput of the Radiant Path." I mean, and the stars of the films also said, you know, we are taking these characters come out of our Soviet reality. So it was both following the afterlives of the idea of the women's sewing commune in Chernyshevsky, but also, you know, following the canon. I mean, in some ways it's a very canonical. I'm not recovering lesser known writers. I'm following a theme that I think is maybe hidden but important to the development of the Russian canon and its uses and transformations in Soviet culture. I had a lot of fun with this part of the project too, and it also kind of inspired the next project that I've been working on. Which is more about the stylistics of Soviet cinema and exactly how the affects of Soviet cinema are transmitted through the specific technological and cinematographic techniques of Soviet cinema in the 1930s.
That sounds like an exciting project. I was planning to ask you if you have a favorite chapter, and it sounds like though that chapter 5 might be it. Am I right?
Well, I have to say, I mean, the Chekhov chapter is really the moral center of the book, and it was it was when I was crafting the book as a book that was like writing about Chekhov really brought the stakes of the book into focus, in part because I was on both ends of the time frame of the book, we have such clear and ideological visions for what women ought to represent and what women ought to do for society in the hands of these male writers and in the hands of a film apparatus not thoroughly controlled but shaped by the by the Soviet state. So in some ways, it was more direct to write about the ideological appropriations of this representation of women's relationships. But to see in Chekhov's writing, cynicism about that idealization, and yet, a humanism, kind of humanism that allows relationships among women to stand for, just the most basic kinds of care for the vulnerable and for the earth. That was what made the stakes of the project feel contemporary to me.
So one of the things that your book does in charting this 80-year period is to show how there is sort of an idealized community of women, starting with Chernyshevsky, and then around the turn of the century, specifically in this your Chekhov chapter, the inoperative, we see how there's fragmentation, and then you chart the re-enchantment in the chapter Bolshevik, and in your epilogue, you sort of gesture toward the possibility for, again, fragmentation, suggesting that we might have kind of a continuum of pendulum swings. Would you care to elaborate a little bit on what comes after the Bolshevik period in terms of women's communities?
Yeah, and in some ways that epilogue, points to, I hope to point to new work that others might do. But I think as much as there's fragmentation, I might even, in the wake of some of the protests of, recent weeks and years, see as much a kind of mobilization of some of Gorky's imagination of the possibilities for kind of women's community to stand for a kind of spontaneous uprising, spontaneous anger that might be needed. I mean, I think the Pussy Riot actions have been, and this is a little bit, I hesitate to go beyond my expertise, but I think they've been indicative of the power of some of the continued power of this performance of women's solidarity to have revolutionary and shocking potential. So as much as I think maybe in the fiction of the post-Soviet period, we see more evidence for fragmentation and hesitance to romanticize. I think there's also been, and in the Me Too movement too, right? There's been more of a willingness to see women's solidarity as a progressive force that has potential in the world today. It's also I'll back up a little bit to say that the book started in some ways as a kind of feminist reading of Russian literature, to add to works like Barbara Helt's Terrible Perfection, a recovery of reading of spaces between women in Russian culture. And as I rewrote the project in dialogue here at the in my department at Johns Hopkins, it was first the Humanities Center and was only recently renamed the Department of Comparative Thought and Literature, I pushed away from the explicitly feminist reading. I mean, thinking through the project as a recovery, and thought about ways in which these motifs or these images of women's relations was also a kind of performative. I mean, kind of a gave the possibility for thinking how women together ought to perform their femininity, right? They shifted away from representation and thought about active performance of gender roles and the way in which Russian literature and culture made certain kinds of roles available for women, for you know, people who identify as women in Russian culture. And also, this also allowed me to see figures like the cross-dressing pilgrim in Tolstoy's War and Peace, who with whom Maria has this interesting relationship, and even the kind of disavowal of gender at the end of Resurrection, as really interesting sites of awareness of the way in which gender can be performed. So that was this all to say that you know, the book went through this transformation, and then I forgot the beginning of what I was trying, where I was going in all of this. What was it that you asked me? Sorry.
Oh, just about the kind of cyclical nature of idealization of women's communities, yes, versus these moments when there's more fragmentation, yes, I guess, in the representations.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. And so then when I got to, when I got to reading also the cinematic and thinking through the roles for which the modes of identification made available to Soviet spectators in the 1930s, I also looked at these films, initially through through a kind of psychoanalytic lens to, understand where the avenues of desire, what avenues of desire were made available in films with female heroines, women, in relation to other women. Okay, I'm going to strike that too. That was not so good. I got lost in my cycle, but I was headed somewhere about...
Was it to do with the contemporary? Because my yeah, question also sort of touched on the notion that we see this continual pendulum swing, where we go from idealization to fragmentation, back to idealization with the re-enchantment of the Soviet period, and then mm-hmm, post-Soviet fragmentation. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of the standard reaction that we see in literary history also being manifested in the representations of women's communities, should we not hasten to extrapolate, right, and just keep our focus on the period under consideration in your book? I don't want to force you to
go
beyond,
okay,
the parameters of the book, which is kind of where I was headed in referencing your epilogue.
I think the problem was that I was headed too far back in order to make a simple point about the politics of today, because I ended up the previous comment about the relevance of thinking through the uses to which idealized images of women have been put in the era of Me Too, and this sense of both women's political the potential of women to be seen as a political actors, communal political actors, but then also the importance of seeing these ideals as kind of performative roles to be put on and used in various ways. I mean, and that sense of performativity also, I think, fuels a That kind of awareness of the performative roles, or the potential of these roles to be not essential, not biological, but kinds of performances that are made available by the canon, by this accumulation of cultural memory, also allows for, you know, fragmentariness to be politically politically progressive. I mean, there'd be a politics to fragmentation, and a merit to having to fragmentation. I'm not sure I would claim there to be a cyclical. I won't make any predictions about the future, but I think that's where we are now. I mean, in this moment of fragmentation of ideals, you know, in part in reaction to the politics of today, and you know, a modern sense of no stereotypes. For stereotypes to be parodied, mocked, undermined, you know, that's part of our modern sense, and that's one of the reasons I included the treatment of Kira Muratova's Chekhovian motifs, because I think she makes so visible the performativity of all sorts of roles in that film.
It sounds like another, if not a book, then at least article on gender performativity and women's political activism in the post-Soviet period would be really fascinating. I also can think of the Ukrainian group Femen that is using their bodies in a very political way. Not to put anything more on your plate, but I could imagine that being a wonderful article. So, Anne, I feel I've taken up enough of your time already. But before we go, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about what you're working on. I know you mentioned that you are thinking about expanding on the Soviet cinema angle.
Yes, I've been working for quite some time now, actually, on a book that I've tentatively titled The Special Effects of Soviet Wonder. And there are a few articles out there in the world, actually one that just came out this past month from the journal Film History on Alexander Ptushko's film, The New Gulliver. It's a Soviet adaptation of Gulliver's Travels, and it combines stop motion animation and live action, to imagine a young pioneer who finds himself, wakes up in Lilliput, and, you know, brings socialist revolution to Lilliput. But it came out of, it really did come out of that chapter five and trying to understand how exactly cinema strives to work on its spectator, and my hunch that there's something different about the way Soviet cinema in this in its classical formative decade of the 1930s developed in opposition to the classical Hollywood paradigms of montage and continuity cinema editing, as opposed to some of the strange disruptive moments in Stalinist cinema that really try to immerse the spectator, kind of permeate through the screen, and impose the kind of notion of community that's being generated on screen, and to incorporate the spectator, the Soviet spectator, into that community, not through kind of not as much through immersion in the continuity of the narrative, but instead in the visual, affective, emotional register. And so I've been working for some time on uncovering some of the specific tactics and stylistics of that period. It's taken me more in this media studies investigation of the technology of Soviet cinema. So I've been really fascinated by the cinematographer Vladimir Nielsen, who created some of the best tricks of Grigory Aleksandrov's films of the 1930s, the combination shooting. But what does it mean to create Soviet special effects, when Soviet cinema is ostensibly a mimetic representation of Soviet reality? You know, why do you need special effects exactly to get that across? So what would the special effects of Soviet cinema be on the spectator, and how do we get there?
And that sounds like another really wonderful project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed hearing about your book, Only Among Women, Philosophies of Community in the Russian and Soviet Imagination, 1860 to 1940.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.